Why should 535 people in Washington be entitled to issue commands to 300 million others? And why should the others obey? These questions, as I argue in the following pages, have no satisfactory answers. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. That's an excellent quote from this book, The Problem of Political Authority, an examination of the right to coerce and duty to obey by professor at University of Boulder, Colorado, Michael Humer. Mr. Humer, thank you for your time, sir.
Yes, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So what is political authority?
So political authority is a hypothesized moral property that the government would have, which would explain why they're entitled to force everybody else to obey their commands, and would also explain why we would be obligated to obey their commands in circumstances in which you would not have to obey similar commands by anyone else, and no one else would be entitled to enforce similar commands.
Now, we have a number of objections that I've come across in researching your opposition, so to speak. So I'd like to present you with those arguments and let me know if you think any of these justify the existence of political authority or what your response would be. One of the major responses we get is, you, Mr. Humer, know the laws that exist in society, yet you choose to stay in this very society. Therefore, you consent to it. If you don't like it, please feel free to move. How do you respond?
Yeah. I mean, would this argument work for anybody else, right? So, you know, let's say that I just go around to my neighbors and I start just issuing commands to them and then demanding money from them. And let's say I've been doing this for a while. So after I've been doing this for 6 months, I say to all my neighbors, look, you can leave if you don't like what I'm doing to you, right? And since you stayed in this place where you know that I'm exploiting you, that means that you've agreed to be exploited by me. So now you have to do everything I say and you have to pay me money or whatever. It's superficially analogous to if somebody is in your house and you say, hey, you know, we have whatever, follow these rules, otherwise you have to leave, you know, like you have no shoes in the house, right? Take off your shoes, otherwise get out of my house. You can say that. That's okay, but that's okay because it's your house. You can't go over to somebody else's house and then say, hey, you got to take off your shoes, otherwise get out of your house, right? And the government is like the second thing, right? The government has just like, they're just here and they're just saying, you know, you can't reside on your own property unless you agree to obey them, right? That's not legitimate, right?
So the difference is that in one situation, it's just some guy showing up to my house. With government, we actually have debates. We have public displays of whose ideas are what. And then we as a society vote, expressing our preferences for what the rules should be. Therefore, the existence of voting is equal to us being represented in society, which is an extension of our consent. How would you respond?
Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned two things, that we have debates and, you know, discussions where all the different ideas are able to interplay. And then the second thing you mentioned is that we vote. And so you get presumably the majority opinion, right? Now, this is oversimplified in a number of ways, okay? There are ways in which you can get laws that are unpopular, right, which the majority of people do not agree with. That happens sometimes. But, you know, that isn't really the main point anyway, right? The main point is, how does a majority of people get the right to force their will on the minority, right? Right. So I have a story that's an analogy for this, where I go to a restaurant with some friends and, you know, graduate students. And at the end of the meal, after everybody's enjoyed the meal and the drinks and whatever, we have a discussion about who should pay, right? And I suggest everybody should pay for the stuff that they ordered, right? And then a student says, I think Humer should pay for everyone. I go, no, I don't want to pay for everyone. And they go, okay, well, let's have a discussion of this, right? And then they have a debate about whether I should be forced to pay for everyone, right? And I'm allowed to participate in the debate, right? Full free speech, right? So I give my objections to forcing you to pay and everything. But then in the end, the majority of the other people vote that I have to pay for everyone. Okay. And so question, are they now entitled to force me to pay? So if I don't take out my wallet and hand over the money, can they now kidnap me and lock me in a cage somewhere? Also, am I morally obligated to hand over the money? Because, you know, the other people at the table wanted me to, right? Okay, I take it the answer is no. And, you know, this is a completely fair analogy to what the government does, right? Okay, you might think it's a little bit unfair because, you know, asking me to pay for everyone, maybe you think that's more unfair than the things that the government usually does. So if I change it to, they force me to pay for, you know, like half of the entire bill, right? And I'm one of several people. And they're demanding that I should pay for half of it. That's totally realistic. That's totally like what the government does, right? They force a small minority of society to pay the majority of the taxes to provide services to everyone else. In fact, what it's really like is they want me to pay more than the bill so that I can give kickbacks to the poor students, right, who ordered food but don't have a lot of money. They want money from me, so I pay like, you know, more than 100% of the bill, and then the extra money goes to the graduate students, right? Okay, and that's like our system.
Now, I have a argument brought to us by Cass Sunstein and Stephen Holmes in their long essay titled "The Cost of Rights: Why Liberty Depends on Taxes." They say, there are no legally enforceable rights in the absence of legally enforceable duties. All rights are claims to an affirmative governmental response. So the reason you might see something as a negative right, me not enslaving you, the very fact that I will be stopped by the police from enslaving you is actually a positive right. There are only positive rights. The only reason we have any sort of semblance of peace is because of the state. The state only exists because of taxes. Therefore, taxes are morally and economically justifiable.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the main, most obvious way I disagree with that is that I'm an anarchist, so anarcho-capitalist. So I don't think that enforcement of rights depends upon the state. I think it could be enforced. They could be enforced by private organizations. I also kind of think that this idea is confusing having rights with the enforcement of rights. So if you have a right, I think it's true that you have a right to the enforcement of that, but that's not a positive right. So if you have a right to something, it's permissible for you to use force to defend that right. It's also permissible for a third party to use force to defend that right. But I don't think that that means that you can force a third party to help you enforce your rights. You can't do that, right? So like in that sense, the enforceability, it's a negative right, not a positive right, right? Like you can't demand that other people enforce it just because it's your right. You could if you have a contract. So if you hired somebody to enforce your rights, then you can demand that they do that. But, you know, that's just like all rights. That's not like, you know, the welfare rights, right, that the left posits, right? Now, does the government have an obligation to protect people? Well, it does because it has an obligation that's based upon its other wrongful actions, right? So the government has forcibly prevented private enforcement of rights. So, right, so they won't allow, you know, private protection agencies to operate. And so because they're doing that, they're obligated to provide the service, right? And they're doing that doesn't make it all okay, right? But, you know, it's less bad than if they prevent you from getting private defense and then refuse to defend you themselves, right?
Now, one thing you are not appreciating is the benefits that you reap from the state. The state has given us roads, highways, schools, which educate millions of people, which give you an educated society to live in. We have foreign justice with the U.S. military. We have domestic justice with the police. Therefore, taxation is simply a price you pay, just like you would pay anything else, but it's very hard to exclude some people when they protect us from the terrorists. Therefore, the state is morally justified in coercing you because we don't have any economic way of excluding others from these benefits you and other anarchists are so unappreciative of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so you mentioned four different benefits, and I think at least three of those are clearly not public goods. All right, so you mentioned roads, schools, police, and the military. Well, you can exclude people from roads. I mean, what's the problem with that, right? Just like any other land, you could like keep people off it. So, you know, we're not gonna say land is a public good now, right? Schools, yeah, you can easily exclude people from schools. So just don't let the students enroll, whatever. In fact, we do that all the time. And police protection. Well, I mean, there are spillover effects, like spillover benefits from police protection. But basically, yeah, you can totally exclude people from that. So the police could say, you know, you have to pay a certain amount of money every month. Otherwise, you're not protected. And what that would mean is if somebody commits a crime against you, the government doesn't do anything about it. Right? So like that would be excluding people from the police protection. Okay, so like, you know, somebody is accused of committing a crime against you, and then it comes out in court that you didn't pay your bill, then they go case dismissed. Right? So like they could totally do that. So it's a private good. So there's no need to have the government provide that, these things, right? Okay, what about the military? I mean, so some of what the military is doing, I don't want them to do, right? Actually, most of what they're doing. You know the amount of money that they're taking for this, right? So I don't know what the recent figures are, right? But the U.S. is the largest military spender in the world by, like, the last time I checked, which was years ago, it was by a factor of six, right? In other words, we were spending more on the military, six times more than the number two military spender, right? And my point there is the overwhelming majority of what they're doing is not necessary, right? Because I think, like, if you have the largest military in the world, that's the most that you could conceivably say that you need. And so anything that's above being the largest, which means, you know, if you're six times larger, then 5/6 of what you're doing is unnecessary, at least, right? Anyway, okay. But still, they're probably doing, you know, at least some of it is probably necessary. Yeah, I mean, then we basically have to talk about how the anarchist society could be safe from invasion, right? You know, part of what the government is doing is preventing non-government solutions, right? So, I mean, this is, you know, sort of like digressing a little bit, but with the roads, schools, and police, the reason why only the government is providing these things is that, well, they basically prevented other people from providing them. So they don't prohibit private schools, but at least at the pre-college level, the government gives themselves a huge advantage. And the huge advantage is people have to pay regardless of whether they use the service. Okay, if a private company could do that, they would totally take over an industry, right? Okay, anyway, so like part of why I'm not grateful is like they're prohibiting you or otherwise sort of like interfering with you getting the good from anyone else. And then they say, you know, you should be so grateful to us, right? That we're providing this, otherwise you wouldn't have it. Yeah, we wouldn't have it because you won't let anyone else provide it. But anyway, okay, back to the military. No, there's kind of like, there's a long discussion that you have to have about how we would have security without a government military in like the anarcho-capitalist society, which like we don't have time to go into all of that. I would say, you know, like one interesting fact that you might not be aware of is that there are 15 countries in the world that do not have a military. Right, so that's like just empirical evidence that it's not the case that you're immediately taken over if you don't have a military, right? The largest of these countries is Costa Rica. Some of them are island nations, so then, you know, like, you can kind of understand why they're more secure than if they have other countries on the border, okay? But, you know, other things to mention are the effectiveness of guerrilla warfare, right? Like, people frequently today, this happens in the gun control debate. People say, like, private individuals cannot defend themselves against a government. And then you remind them that that has happened multiple times, right? Like, very powerful government militaries have been defeated by non-government forces many times in the 20th century. Happened to the United States, in Vietnam, it happened to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, happened to the French, it happened to the English, okay? And I mentioned those because those are the four most militarily powerful nations in world history, and they were all defeated by guerrilla warfare, right? By non-government militaries. Okay, now, you don't want that to happen. Like, you don't want to have any conflict at all, okay? So, like, going into guerrilla warfare is like a last resort, but, you know, I'm just pointing out that it's not totally infeasible. Anyway, there's a whole chapter about this in The Problem of Political Authority about, you know, military defense, which I think people should just read that chapter in its entirety.
Now, I am so terrified that the poor will not be taken care of in the absence of a state. Currently, we have the state going to very large extents to make sure that the poor have these things. Whereas if we don't have a state, we might get large portions of our society not taken care of in the marketplace. As much as I like the idea of things being voluntary and peaceful and all that, we have poor people who simply need help and won't have that help in the absence of a state. Therefore, the state is justified on utilitarian grounds. How do you respond?
Yeah, okay. Good question. I mean, you know, a few things to point out. It's relevant to point out that it's not totally obvious that the government's anti-poverty programs are helping rather than harming. I think there's a non-stupid argument that they might actually be increasing poverty. This is argued by Charles Murray in his famous book, Losing Ground. And what Murray says is, well, you know, government spending on social welfare programs dramatically increased since from the start of the 1960s, and poverty did not go down. And in fact, you know, it looked like maybe got worse, right? And his explanation for this, the theoretical explanation, is something like the government poverty programs make it easier in the short term to engage in behaviors that are self-destructive in the long term, right? So like they soften the cost of doing things like losing your job, dropping out of school, having children out of wedlock. So that, you know, the government gives you money when you do that. But in the long term, this is gonna stop you from getting ahead in life, right? So like, I think it's not at all obvious that the government is helping the problem of poverty, and, you know, rather than making it worse. Anyway, the other thing to say is, so try a thought experiment. Let's say that I'm running a charity that helps the poor. And let's say that I feel like there's not enough voluntary contributions, which is what people say about, like, you know, when I say, hey, you know, if you want to help the poor, just donate to one of these private charities that are helping the poor. Okay, and then people say, yeah, but they're not going to get enough money, right? So let's say that I'm running one of these charities and I feel like I'm not getting enough voluntary contributions. And so I just go out and I start mugging people, right? Like, you know, meet people on the street. I say, you look like you've got some money. And then I point the gun at them. Hand over your money. Don't worry, it's going to the poor. Is this good behavior on my part? Like, I think most people would agree this is not good behavior, right? This does not seem very good. Okay, now, if you're okay with that, like, so there are some, you know, like, if you're a hardcore leftist, you might say, yeah, that's totally fine, do that, right? So if that's your view, then this argument didn't work on you, okay? But most people think, no, you can't do that. Okay, well, if you can't do that, then the government doesn't have any better reason for what it's doing, right? What it's doing is kind of the same thing, so.
Now, what... we need to also assume is that in the absence of a state, we would have drastic wealth inequality. This would create a terrible imbalance of power where a small group of individuals would have virtual domination in society, leaving us sort of at their whim. They want something to be done. They have all the money and resources. Effectively enslaving the rest of us. Does the potential of drastic wealth inequality justify the existence of political authority?
Well, you know, I mean, all of that sounded like a very trenchant observation about our society, right? And, you know, the group that has total domination is the government. That's what they're called. Right? So, like, okay, you know, let's have some group that has total domination over society in order to prevent that same thing from happening is a little bit weird. You know, so I'm not terribly worried about wealth inequality per se. I am more worried about power inequality, right? Which is exactly why there's a problem with having government, because that's just like exactly what it is, right? Now, why am I not worried about wealth inequality per se? I don't think that there's any intrinsic value to equality. I think that there's something bad about people who are unable to meet their needs, right? If you can't meet your basic needs, that's bad. But if you can meet your basic needs, but you just don't have as much extra stuff as somebody else has, so what? I don't care. Okay, now, I have discussions of this in academic articles, right? I would say that I've proved that equality has no intrinsic value, okay? But it's kind of take a while, and it requires some diagrams to show that, to go through that argument. So I'll just like, you know, I'll just say dogmatically that I don't think it has intrinsic value. And then you can read my papers on this. What else? Okay, sometimes people worry that, wealth inequality leads to political inequality, right? Like that's the problem with it. That's mostly if you have a state, right? And the reason that that's true is that you use your money to buy congressmen or things like that, right? Okay, that is, you find the congressmen who you think are going to serve the interests of your company, and then you donate to their campaigns and stuff like that, right? And then, you know, you find congressmen who you don't like what they're doing, and then you kind of like fund a primary challenger or something like that. Okay, that's why wealth inequality leads to political inequality. Like, I don't see how it happens if you don't have a state.
Yes, the best example of this is, you know, someone like Donald Trump. It's like, but we were bugged by him, you know, 10, 20 years ago, but we were never terrified that he was going to start a war, that he was going to steal trillions annually, that he was going to lie us and expand welfare programs. He's drastically expanded the money supply to the point where we're experiencing inflation already. So we actually have a real world example of a billionaire who, while he had power, it was nothing like political power. This is, I think this actually refutes the case almost completely, that we need to worry about market inequality. It's political inequality that really allows people to enforce their evil. I mean, private citizen Henry Kissinger or Chairman Mao, can't imagine they would commit their atrocities if we saw them as equals, more or less.
That's a great example. Right? Like, I mean, you know, for all the people who hate Trump, it's a great example, right? Because they were nowhere near as upset or as worried, nor should they be, when he was just a realtor, just a real estate developer.
The predatory, evil, dog-eat-dog private sector. Now he serves us and only acts when we vote for him to do so. It's the opposite of what they tell us. Back to me being the devil's advocate. Corporations need regulation. If not for this regulation, people in very high positions of power would simply wreck the environment. They have no incentive. They wouldn't protect their employees, who have much less wealth and are sort of at the mercy of their employer. And nor would consumers be protected. Using a saw that could cut your hand off, you could lose a finger. If we have a state, however, we are able to curb their negative influence. We're able to check their products and services before they release them to the public, trying to profit off our backs and our labor. Therefore, the state is morally justified insofar as it curbs imbalances of power to make sure we have a general level of safety and security in society.
Yeah. Good. So you mentioned three kinds of regulations. There's environmental regulation, regulation to protect workers, and regulations to protect consumers. And I think that there's an important difference between the first one and the other two, right? The difference with environmental regulation is there's actually negative externalities. So like, you know, if you're just putting pollution out into the air, then you're imposing costs on just, you know, everyone else. Putting a small cost, right, on everyone else who breathes, and you don't have to pay for that cost. And if you're, you know, if you're a libertarian rights theorist, you might even think it's a rights violation, right? The case of protecting workers and consumers is different, because just like in a normal competitive market, there are forces to protect the workers and the consumers, right? It's like in an ordinary competitive market. Granted, there are mistakes in the real world, but you know, in theory, there's a mechanism for protecting them, which is, well, if your job is really crappy and dangerous and so on, then that cost goes into the desirability of you working for your firm, which means like you have to pay more to get workers to work there than a firm that was more safe, which means you have an economic incentive to make your firm reasonably safe, right? Not maximally safe, right? But rather sort of you have the incentive to make it as efficient as possible, right? To make the safety improvements that are worth it to the workers, right? So if they would rather have more money and less safe conditions, then you do that, right? Anyway, one of the things I think that people forget about is, although it is within the government's power to fix a bunch of problems, it is also within their power to worsen a bunch of problems. So you have to think about, well, okay, so they have the power to regulate, but are they going to make only good regulations? Or will they be sometimes making harmful regulations? Because they can do that too, right? They can solve public goods problems, but they can also create public bads, so to speak, right? Okay, well, I mean, there have been studies of regulation, right? So I recall, I like to repeat this periodically. I recall reading an interview with Ronald Coase. This was in Reason magazine. I don't know the name of the interview anymore, but you can probably find it if you search. Okay, so they interview Ronald Coase, and, you know, famous economist, Nobel Prize winning economist, and he was also the editor of, I think it was the Journal of Law and Economics, for like 20 years, okay? And he says during the interview that they published a lot of studies of the effects of a variety of different regulations, right? And they just kept turning out to be bad, right? They kept turning out to be counterproductive or to just have costs that were greater than the benefits. Now, government regulatory agencies regularly prospectively estimate large net benefits from their regulations, right? But later, when economists study the actual effects of the regulations, they usually conclude that it was more harmful, right? More harmful than beneficial. And, you know, the interviewer, but Coase says, but I don't think that all regulations are bad. I think we need some regulations. And the interviewer says, okay, so can you give me an example of a regulation that was good? And he's like, well, there wasn't one. Okay, now in fairness, probably they were only studying regulations, or there was at least a bias towards regulations that were controversial. Probably you did not have economists studying regulations that were generally agreed to be beneficial. They probably only studied if there was a question about it. Okay, but so in such cases though, it regularly turns out that it's harmful. There are a lot of studies of individual regulations. There's like a few articles in economics about kind of regulation in general, trying to estimate the costs, and you get very large net costs. Okay, so there was one article that estimated that it might have, actually now I've forgotten what the number was. It was estimating that it had reduced GDP growth by either 1% or 2% or something per year, and the result of that over the last 50 years is just a huge cost, right? Like tens of trillions of dollars, okay? All right, so, you know, like you have to sort of, there's like the theory of what government would do if it was angelic, but then there's what it does if it's staffed by just like normal humans who are flawed and selfish and sometimes stupid, and, you know, sometimes they don't know what they're doing and sometimes they just don't care that much about, you know, the rest of society. And what happens in that circumstance, which is reality, is, you know, not that great, right?
Exactly. I mean, we have also cases of regulatory capture where Hank Paulson leaves Goldman Sachs to become Secretary of the Treasury. Or we have OSHA regulations, I believe it was OSHA, where they stop Elvis Summers and Jay Austin from building houses that would cost about $1,500, virtually solving the homeless problem with total voluntary contributions. So yeah, looking at the secondary effects is vital to understanding the situation. Now, if we have no state, there will be no final arbiter in disputes that will arise in society. So this will lead to a constant war of all against all, as Thomas Hobbes correctly explained to us, each one of us taking the law into our own hands, each one of us having very different opinions on how things should be. This would render us into a state of chaos. The state is therefore justified because of a very real potential for the existence of chaos.
Yeah, okay, good. So the famous sort of Hobbesian argument, right, which might be the most popular argument for the government. Basically, the anarcho-capitalist view is we need to privatize the functions of the police and the courts, not that we need to get rid of them, right? I think there's a problem that people don't know what the anarcho-capitalist theory is. As soon as they hear that you're an anarchist, they think that you have this completely idiotic view. Right, that like there should be no institutions and just everybody does anything at any time. Like, that's not anybody's view, right? It's that you can privatize these functions, all right? And by the way, like, how anarchy would go depends a lot on how it comes about. So if the government just disappeared like that today with everything, you know, else the way that it is, then there would be chaos in the streets the next day, right? But there are possible transitions that would make it go smoothly, right? So the government could start outsourcing, so to speak, right? That is, there are government police patrolling a lot of areas. They could start outsourcing that to private companies, like private security guards could start patrolling. And the people who are living in a particular small area, like an apartment building or a neighborhood of houses, they could decide which among many competing security agencies they want to be patrolling their area. Okay, so like this could start, you know, this could start and spread gradually. And then eventually it could be that all or almost all of the police are private security guards, right? And if this happens, I don't see the chaos breaking out, right? Okay, and then you worry about the resolution of disputes, right? We still need the government to resolve disputes or like, assess guilt or innocence of accused criminals, and no, they can outsource that too, actually, right? There are private arbitration companies right now, and the government courts could start referring more and more cases to private arbitration, right? And just say, you know, okay, we don't want to hear this. Here's a list of arbitrators in your area. You guys pick an arbitrator, right? They could do that, and then so then the court system could gradually shrink. And if that's the way it comes, if that's the way that the abolition of government comes about, I don't see, you know, sudden chaos coming about.
Now, I'm curious about what you think of the mindset of the person who asks a question like this, because I don't think they're really asking what, you know, they say when they say something to the extent of, who will provide roads, courts, police, and military? How will this get done? And who will provide it?
Well, I mean, what are they thinking? They're thinking like they have no idea what the anarchist is thinking, right? So, you know, you see a bunch of stuff that's provided by the government, and then somebody says, let's get rid of the government. And then, like, the first kind of, like, the simplest reaction you could have is, well, then everything the government is doing won't be done, right? I mean, there's a certain sort of, like, obvious logic to that. And then, you know, if you just didn't think the next step, right, the next thing that you should think is this person who is calling himself an anarchist does not seem retarded. And he also doesn't seem insane. So he probably doesn't actually think the ridiculous thing that I just thought he was thinking, right? Like, you should think that. But actually, I mean, this is very common that people don't try to think what the other person's view might be, right? Like, okay, we must have some story about how this gets provided. Okay, but maybe then they're thinking, okay, but what's the story about how it's provided? Like, okay, now, I mean, it's not that hard to think of it though. Like, I mean, you know, surely, especially if you know the person's a libertarian, surely they're gonna say the market can provide it. Now, I think there is some question, like, so for some goods, there is a serious question about how the market provides it. So, you know, when you have public goods, I think, you know, there's a question about whether we can provide them. The roads are a little bit hard to provide, right? I mean, it's a little bit hard because, like, it's hard to get adequate competition, right? Like, I don't know, where, like, are you going to have, like, five roads that are, what, stacked on top of each other by different companies or something? Not sure, like, or next to each other? And then there's like a really inefficient land use there, right? You might worry about that. I think that in the case of protection of the environment, I think like that's a serious question because there's a public goods problem. And so like, yeah, we will not get the optimal amount of environmental protection. Like, I think that's just true. And we are still going to have global warming. That's going to keep happening. Okay. However, I would remind everyone that we're getting that anyway. Like, that stuff is going to happen anyway, even though we have the government, and in theory, the government could stop global warming. They could like reduce pollution, whatever. And they are doing some of it, but you know, they're not doing the most efficient amount, even though in theory it's possible for them to, and we're not going to have the most efficient amount without the government either. But there are a bunch of other problems that the government produces that we will not have, right?
Exactly. And what I really like about this book, The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and Duty to Obey, is anytime you take a criticism, you say, yeah, that is a really good criticism. It's going to be hard to distribute justice in society with hundreds of millions of people. By the way, giving a group of people a coercively funded monopoly does not solve this issue. In fact, it applies tenfold because they don't have the incentive of, hey, we might lose our funding if we, you know, choke Eric Garner to death, or if we kill a bunch of churchgoers in Texas, or if we lie people into a Gulf of Tonkin war based on an event that didn't even happen, or they lie us into Iraq. I mean, the idea that things are imperfect, therefore this group has a coercively funded monopoly on law and order in society. It's like the greatest non sequitur. And I'm sorry, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I think there's a problem that people kind of apply different ways of reasoning to the market versus the government, right? When they're reasoning about the government, they sort of idealize it and assume that the government is going to do the best thing that's within its power to do or something. And when they think about the market, they think about how most people are selfish and assume that agents in the market are going to behave selfishly. And, you know, the second thing is correct. People are selfish, but what's wrong is failing to apply that to the government. And then when you realize that the government is staffed by the same kind of selfish entities, namely humans, as companies are in the market, okay, then you have to start thinking about the incentive structure. And the incentive structure with government is really bad. They have a monopoly, which means that if they totally fuck up, you still have no one else to turn to, right? If they totally fuck up, you cannot fire them and go to their competitor because they don't have a relevant competitor, right? And you know, and then you think, oh yeah, but it's going to be fixed by democracy. But then if you spend some time thinking about the incentive structures of democracy, you realize that that's totally fucked up, right? You realize that the voters have no incentive to pay attention. Because like my probability of flipping the outcome of an election is like one in a million, you know, between one in a million and one in 10 million or something like that, right? So I'm just not going to spend any time, you know, trying to research issues or find out what this politician's real voting record is and so on, because I'm just going to get whoever the majority of ignoramuses elect anyway, on the basis of like who's better looking or who spent more money on campaign ads and stuff like that, right? So like that's the incentives on the voters. And then the incentives on the politicians are, well, okay, that means that we don't have to pay attention to what's actually good or bad, right? Because the voters aren't paying attention. They don't know what we're doing, right? And I use this illustration, you know, periodically for students. I ask them if they can identify like the last vote that their congressman did, right? First, can you identify who your congressman is? And most people don't know that. If you don't even know the person's name, right, how are you like keeping that person in line? But then if I ask, but you know, like maybe half of the people know the person's name, okay? But then I ask, okay, and like, what was the last vote that he did in Congress? And like, nobody ever knows, right? Unless you ask this right after a really famous vote, right? Like, you know, the impeachment vote. If I asked right after the impeachment on Trump vote, then a substantial number of people would know how their congressman voted. But other than that, in the ordinary course of events, people have no idea what the person is doing, which means there's no incentive for the congressman to be careful that they're serving the interests of their constituents.
What would you say is the principal difference between a state making laws that citizens need to follow or they get punished versus a homeowners association, which has For example, a no drinking alcohol policy. Oh, okay, so let's just use that. What is the difference between the American president outlawing alcohol and prohibition versus an HOA outlawing alcohol in their neighborhood? Is it just size?
Yeah, I mean, well, I assume we should be talking about the legislature outlawing alcohol or whatever. Yeah, what's the difference? So, I mean, there are two important differences between government and market provision of whatever, you know, of a product or whatever. The differences are voluntariness versus coercion and competition versus monopoly. Okay, so with a homeowners association, you have an actual contract, right? Not the fictional contract like the social contract, but like an actual literal contract where there's a piece of paper that says the terms and there's your signature on the bottom of it. That's what I mean by a contract. Not like somebody just said, you have to agree to this or get out of your own house. Okay, so, and with the government, you don't have a contract, right? You didn't agree. You were just born into it, and then they just say, you have to have us. Like, you have to obey us or else. And then there's the difference of competition, which is there's more than one homeowners association, and there's only one government. Right now, that's like you might say, well, not exactly, because you can move to another country to get another government. And also, like, you could move to another neighborhood to get a different HOA. Okay, so the real difference is that there's sort of like the competition is more meaningful in the case of an HOA because the costs of switching to the competitor are much lower. There are costs, right? There are significant costs of if you don't like your HOA and you want to get a different one, there are significant costs. Like if you're a homeowner, you have to sell your home and there are big transaction costs. So, okay, that's true. So for that reason, HOAs can kind of screw up a fair amount, right? But, you know, there is still a limit because they can't screw up so much that it's worth it to you to sell your house to get away from them. Okay. Now with the government, also it is maybe possible to move, but the costs are way higher. So you have to leave behind your society, which means you might leave behind the whole culture that you're familiar with, and you have to leave behind your family and friends. You're going to have to abandon your job in most cases, right? Furthermore, you may not even be legally able to move, right? Because all or almost all countries in the world have immigration restrictions. And so you have to try to find a country that will let you in. And there may not be any country that doesn't have a tyrannical government that will let you in, right? So, it's just that there's a lot less competition among governments. There, in some sense, there's competition, right? Like companies can move operations overseas if they don't like the regulatory regime or the tax regime or whatever, but it's just like much higher costs than in the case of moving from one neighborhood to another neighborhood that has a different HOA, where like, okay, I moved 3 miles, big deal. Okay, and now I had to take the 5% cost from selling my house. Okay, so that's annoying, but not as bad as moving to Mexico, right?
Yes. Now, where the libertarian anarchist position falls short is it turns all human beings that have inherent value simply into dollar signs. If I can't make money off you in this voluntary libertarian society, I'm not going to interact with you. If you don't buy any of our court services, you don't get a court system. The kind, generous statist position allows us to make sure that we do not exclude people based on the arbitrariness of how many Federal Reserve notes they have. Therefore, the statist position is morally superior to the anarchist position, seeing not everyone as mere dollar signs to crank resources out of, but as inherently value human beings.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's seeing them as voters, right? we can give you their vote in the next election. This sort of idea reminds me of a remark by David Friedman. There's this example he gives where, you know, you're thinking of taking an umbrella because it might rain, right? And the point that he makes is taking the umbrella does not make it rain, right? So like, it's just recognizing the fact that it's gonna rain. And if it is, then you should take the umbrella. And like, if you decide that you just hate the thought of rain so much that you just don't want to take the umbrella, then you're just going to get wet. Okay, and now what does this have to do with the government versus the market? Well, capitalism doesn't make people selfish, and government doesn't make people altruistic, right? What's the case is, so people are that way. They're either selfish or altruistic already. But the thing is, like, capitalism uses the selfishness of people in order to produce, right, to produce goods and services. And government just relies on people being altruistic. So, like, I mean, because the idea of government is, let's just give a whole bunch of power to this one group and, like, give them a complete monopoly on the protection and dispute resolution and rulemaking services for society. Like, just give them power over everyone else. Okay, so that does not make them nice people. What that does is it makes it so that in order for society to prosper, those people have to be nice, right? Or, you know, they have to at least not be terrible, okay? And so, and that's sort of like saying, I don't like rain, so I'm not going to take the umbrella, right? I don't like selfishness, so I'm going to create a system that only works if people are not selfish. No, that's not good, right? You should be thinking, I don't like, well, I don't, you don't like selfishness. Nobody likes selfishness, right? Except Ayn Rand. But, you know, you should be thinking, it's still a fact. It's the reality. So how can we design the structure of society so that when people are being selfish like they're going to, it is less bad, right, than, you know, alternative structures, right? And the answer to that is, well, don't have a monopoly of force, right? Don't give one group power over everyone else.
Now, I am very much convinced by your arguments, but I am so terrified of the state not being there to protect me. I have not seen cases of this working historically. Therefore, I'm going to reject it on grounds that we first need to see it actually working before we can embrace this philosophical ideology. So your thesis is illegitimate because no previous examples have existed.
Yeah, unfortunately, if this is a good argument, then we'll never see any examples, right? Or at least if people find that argument persuasive, right? The only way to get the evidence is to try it. Now, but that doesn't mean that this is an unreasonable argument, right? I mean, like, you might think, yeah, we should never try it, right? We'll never find out because it's too risky. And there are some things that are so risky that you should never find out, right? So fair point. I guess I would say, well, what we should do to get more information is we should sort of gradually move in the direction of anarcho-capitalism, right? So as I was suggesting earlier, well, the government could start outsourcing some of its functions, right? And we'll see how it goes, right? And if it goes well, then they can do more, right? So, and actually there is some amount of this happening already, right? So there are private security guard companies, and there are actually more private security guards than government police right now. And you could just have, like, more communities using private security guards instead of police, right? And see how that happens. Like, see how that works. See if they shoot black people as much as the police do, right? And I think the answer is going to be no. I think they're going to be shooting fewer people. And, you know, maybe they'll be doing a better job of patrolling and making people feel safe. Now, if I'm wrong, then we could go back. Right. So the suggestion of moving gradually, I think, is the answer to the risk problem. Similarly about the court system. Right. So we already have arbitration companies. In fact, a lot of business contracts have a clause that says if we have any disputes, they will be resolved by arbitration, by a private company instead of by the government courts. And the reason why companies put this in their contracts, like, and it's not to take advantage of the other company or whoever they're making the contract with. It's like, it's good for both sides because the government courts are incredibly expensive to use and write and not that reliable, and they take forever to get cases resolved and so on. And so, okay, actually, I mean, from the experience that we have now, it seems to be working pretty well. We could try expanding that and just, like, see how it goes, right? We could try having more and more cases resolved by private arbitration. If it doesn't go well, then we can move in the opposite direction. If it goes well, then we keep doing it until all of the courts are private arbitrators, right? Sound good?
Absolutely. So, all right, I'm done playing the devil's advocate here. I want to ask you why you think that there is so little humility in political discussions. I have taken so much time to read books, listen to speeches, watch videos, read opposing arguments, and you realize how much depth there is to even the most things that look totally ridiculous on the outskirt. I mean, like, for example, you know, someone's like, the government sprays chemicals and kills people. And then it turns out Agent Orange was openly used in Vietnam, Operation Sea Spray. So you realize how much depth there really is to humanity. But the average voter has no humility at all. They're very confident in things they know little about. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure if that's true. So I think we get an exaggerated impression of how many dogmatic ideologues there are, because it's the dogmatic ideologues who are the loudest, right? Like, and the people who are reasonable are like sitting there listening, listening quietly and politely. And then, like, you know, the dogmatic people are just like posting all over and tweeting all the time, okay? And anyway, so like, okay, but why are some people dogmatic ideologues? I mean, it's partly because they have no incentive to be rational. So, I mean, this is just like, you know, the kind of the institutional structure of our society. Like, yeah, by thinking rationally about politics, you don't get any reward. And by thinking irrationally, you might think, well, what's the reward of thinking irrationally? Okay, well, there is. I mean, there are sort of emotional rewards, because if you're irrational, you get to believe whatever you want to believe, right? Whatever that might be. Because, like, people are going to have different preferences, and there are going to be different beliefs that they enjoy, right? Like, you take pleasure in certain political beliefs. And if that's the case, then it's in your interest, so to speak, to just like dogmatically cling to those and dismiss any counter arguments and so on, because then you get to continue having the belief that you enjoy, right? So, I mean, that's the Brian Kaplan explanation, which, you know, it seems plausible, I guess. You know, other things you can say, like, well, what about, evolutionary psychology? Like, yeah, I mean, most of the time, it's good to think rationally, like, about things that pertain to your survival and reproduction. But on the other hand, if you just have these, like, ideological beliefs, natural selection wouldn't have designed us to be accurate about philosophy or politics or religion, because, like, that didn't promote survival and reproduction in our past, right? So, like, that could be a sort of connected explanation, right? So.
Now, you have a great chapter in this book titled The Psychology of Authority. So you first, you know, have, you know, that opening quote of, why is it okay that we have such different standards for this group called the state? If I did what they do, I'd be seen as a psycho terrorist and I'd be put in jail, but they do it openly and people pledge their allegiance to them. I'm curious, how do you think it is that the state has created this double standard in the minds of millions of people for thousands of years?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you go back thousands of years, people had pretty terrible values. And so, like, they thought that it was fine to go and attack a neighboring tribe. Or I don't know what they thought, but that's what they did. They would just attack a neighboring tribe for no good reason. I was going to say no reason, but the reason is I don't like those people. They've got some stuff. I'm going to take their stuff. I'm going to kill them. And like, and also, if we attack them and kill the men, then we can kidnap the women and rape them. Right? And the reason why the explanation for why people would do that is evolutionary, right? Because people who did that left behind more offspring. And so. Okay, anyway. But anyway, that was like, so whatever values people had, it didn't stop them from doing that. So they must have had terrible values. And that's when the state arose, right? In the period when people had terrible values. And people's values have gotten better over time. But like once the state gets established, it's hard to get rid of it. So like that's part of what's happened. Also, part of what's happened is this huge status quo bias. So the way that things are going in your society, you just have this kind of natural tendency to assume that that's the way things are supposed to go, right? And the state is just like a very big, prominent aspect of our society, right? It's like our tradition. And so you just think, oh, okay, so that must be okay, right? And most people don't really, they don't question the really big obvious aspects of how their society works. They question things that are sort of question things that are new, like some new law gets passed and they think, is that a really good idea? And you know, things that other people are talking about, you question whether it's good or bad, but if something's just been going on for thousands of years, it's like there's not that many people who will question it. You know, other things the government does, I mean, it's kind of in your self-interest to believe that government is legitimate. If you start disobeying the government, then they come and do nasty things to you. So, like, in a way, you have an interest in believing that you have to obey them. Now, of course, you could just believe that you're obeying them out of fear, right? Which is what I believe, right? I believe that we're basically obeying the government because we're afraid of them, because they're going to fuck us up if we don't obey them. But that's not a very pleasant belief. So what's more pleasant is to believe that we're doing our duty, right? Like when we give them the money that they demand and we obey their rules and so on, we're doing our duty. And that feels a lot better than I've been extorted, okay? I think the truth is you've been extorted, but you know, there's this kind of cognitive dissonance, right? Where you want to believe the positive thing about yourself.
And we also definitely see this sort of psychological missing out or not being part of the cool, popular people, because it's so hard to explain all these concepts. And if it's at the cost of you looking like an idiot, well, you know what? You're probably just going to lie and say, I'll vote after I watch the presidential debates. It's, because the anarchist conversation is so in-depth. I mean, a really good-looking woman walked up to me and asked me to sign this thing, and I just paused for like 10 seconds. I'm like, well, what am I going to do? Give her a speech? I run into her about every other day, or I could just sign it and I can get this off my back and we never have to talk about it again. It's amazing how shame, this is from Thaddeus Russell. He says, shame is the health of the state. I've heard many vegetarians say that the fear of being shamed is what allows people to, you know, kill, what is it, like 57 billion animals a year and stuff like that, which is just hard to curb. Any thoughts on shame being the health of the state on top of they're actually going to kill you? What one more example is, we were at dinner and this guy was a cop. And look, when you've taken an oath to uphold the laws that are so blatantly immoral, I just have I have so much contempt for you. But, and I didn't think that, well, he's going to shoot me if I say I don't respect the police. It was just a shame thing. So, thoughts on shame being the health of the state on top of actual fear of violence being initiated against you?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I was suggesting part of why we're obeying the state, a big part is we're afraid of what they're going to do to us, but also we're kind of like afraid of what our fellow members of society are going to think of us, right? And if you start acting weird, then they're just going to like start avoiding you, and they're going to think that you're a weirdo and so on. You won't have friends, and you know, you won't get dates and whatever. Yeah, I think there's just like an innate tendency in human beings to try to fit in with the rest of society. And that's just because like this whole thing of us being social animals, right? Our whole way of life involves interacting with each other. And so like, it's super important that other people have good opinions of you and they want to cooperate with you. You know, I had a blog post a while back where I was suggesting that, you know, it's the fact that people are conformist and like they don't listen to people with radically different ideas, that's adaptive. Right. Because so, I mean, it's adaptive in one obvious way, which is if you align yourself with the minority, then you're likely to not be so successful. And, you know, a way to align yourself with the majority is to adopt the beliefs that the majority have. Right. So that's adaptive behavior. But also another thing is most of the nonconformists are crazy. That is, most of the time when you hear an idea that's radically different from what most people believe, it's also radically wrong. Right? And the reason for that is, well, you know, like there's just so many crazy ideas. There's so many ways to go wrong, right? And so it's actually adaptive. If you're not able to figure out what the truth is for yourself, it's adaptive to ignore the people who have radical ideas, because most of them are wrong. You're going to be ignoring the truth but you're also going to be ignoring a whole bunch of horrible ideas. And so, like, right? And so I thought about that. I thought, yeah, actually, like, if people are not very smart and educated and able to evaluate for themselves whether my arguments in my book are correct, they should dismiss me. Like, it's rational for them, right? Because, like, if they can't tell why my arguments are better than those of a Marxist, then it's better for them to just dismiss both of us, right? Dismiss me and the Marxists and all the other crazy people. Okay, and so I say that although I am actually correct, right? Like, I actually have the correct arguments. I am one of the very small number of extremists who actually has better ideas than the majority opinion.
Now, I got two more questions for you. I want you to tell me either the most important thing you learned from this person or what you thought their greatest intellectual contribution was to the academic fields. So, Brian Kaplan, what is the most important thing you learned from him or you thought his best contribution was?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, there are two answers. So the answer to the first question is Brian Kaplan introduced me to anarcho-capitalism. And so I don't know if you know this story, right? We were at UC Berkeley. So Brian and I went to college at UC Berkeley at the same time. And so that's where I met him. And then he introduced me to ANCAP. And that's how I became an anarchist. I was already a libertarian, right? And then he told me about this. And my first reaction was anarchism is crazy. But, you know, and then he was able to explain it. And like, he made me read Murray Rothbard and David Friedman. His biggest contribution to just like, you know, other than ANCAP, which, you know, he didn't invent, is, of course, a theory of rational irrationality, right? So the book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, right, that's like the big statement of that. Also a bunch of papers. But and, you know, I use that theory frequently. Like, I invoked it in this discussion.
And Jason Brennan, another one of my favorite philosophers, what's something you learned from him or thought was his best intellectual contribution?
Yeah, I mean, Jason and I basically have the same views, like, it's like, you know, on government and democracy and whatever, and anarchism, although it's not obvious I don't think it's come out in his published philosophical writings that he's an anarchist. I think when people read him, they think that he's an epistocrat, right? That is, you know, a person who believes in the rule of the well-informed or something. And I understand why people would think that, because, like, so he has some good articles about this, about how, you know, you have a right to not be ruled by people who are totally incompetent and ignorant and stupid and whatever, and are not paying attention and so on. And so, you know, the suggestion seems to be, okay, so we should be ruled by the smart, wise, benevolent people or whatever. But I happen to know that his actual view is anarchism. But anyway, so I mean, I think that his criticisms of democracy are probably his biggest contribution, right? And just, you know, pointing out, I mean, like, it's well known how democracy is screwed up. And it's well known among people who look into that sort of thing, not among the general public who have totally incorrect views about democracy. But, you know, like, besides explaining the problems with incentives, right, I think just like explaining how it's totally immoral, right, the system that we have is immoral because, like, you know, you're under the power, just like, you know, without even being a libertarian, right, you can see that there's something wrong with you being under the power of these people who don't know what the hell they're doing and don't care, right? Like, all of these voters don't care. They're not doing research. They don't know what the issues are, right? They're just like taking some tweets that they heard or whatever and voting on the basis of who's good looking or stuff like that. Yeah,
absolutely. Hey, Mr. Humer, thank you so much for your time. Again, the book is The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. Please check it out. And thank you, everyone, for watching Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone.
All right. Thanks for having me.